Welcome, listeners, to this episode of Shooting from the Hip, brought to you by Sim Trainer, the Dayton area's first indoor shooting range and firearms training facility. I want to encourage our callers, if they have any comments, questions, concerns, to call in at 457-1290. That's 457-1290. Today I want to devote at least a portion of the show to talking about firearm selection. And I'm focusing on this topic because in the last several weeks we've had numerous people come to us with questions about firearm selection, and we've had a few come to us for training, and they had a gun already that didn't really work out for them. And what I want to start out by is just mentioning that typically when we're talking about firearm selection, it comes down to whether or not you're going to start with a revolver or a semi-automatic pistol. And I just want to talk generally about some issues that are of concern that you need to think about. I will tell you this, that from a standpoint of ease of operation, strictly ease of operation, revolvers pretty much have semi-autos beat hands down. The problem is, though, for many new shooters, for inexperienced shooters, and for even the experienced shooters that don't shoot a whole lot, if they pick a revolver, a major concern comes into play, and that's trigger, the ability to pull the trigger and to make accurate shots. And that being said, you need to understand that revolvers are very functional weapons. They've been around for a long time, way longer than semi-autos, but this issue about being able to pull the trigger kind of offsets ease of functional operation, because it makes no sense if you can't hit what you're shooting at that you're using one gun over the other.
So there's a lot of different aspects of what makes a gun easier or harder to shoot for some person in particular.
That's exactly right. And we're going to talk about some of those. And in relation to the semi-automatic pistols, typically we tend to put people in either the Glock 19, the Smith & Wesson M&P, and sometimes the Springfield XD Compact because of its ease of operation and its relative ease of trigger pull. And trigger pull tends to be the most determining factor which individuals that come through our training ultimately end up using to select whatever firearm that they choose to go with.
And the reason for the compacts is because people are looking for concealed carry. They're a little easier to conceal.
Yeah, yes. And again, we're primarily looking or talking here about what we would traditionally call snub-nose revolvers and compact or subcompact semi-automatic pistols. And I mentioned the three that I just talked about because when we're talking about functional operation, we're talking about your ability to load the weapon with a magazine and ammunition, to charge the weapon, and then to ultimately fire the weapon accurately. All of them tend to have pros and cons, but the semi-automatic pistols are very similar in that capacity with very few differences. The other thing I want to mention with the semi-automatic pistols is they typically have easier to see sights on the top of the gun, as opposed to many of the revolvers that people are using for concealed carry. They're going to be pretty much relying on a frame integrated rear sight and then a front sight. Now, the trade-off for that is many of you that are looking at for personal safety and security, it's going to be up close and personal point shooting anyway, and it doesn't become an issue. But remember, the way we teach training and the way you need to, or the way we promote training and the way you need to think about training, you need to be good at aimed fire, strictly aimed fire, before you can ever hope to be good at point shooting fire. And it's committing those critical skills to muscle memory that are going to make you a good point shooter. Mark, you want to comment on any of those issues so far?
Yeah, I think one of the big things is that you need to have that gun be a complete automatic extension of your arm. And the only safe way to do that is to learn how to do it first with sighted fire. I mean, people can learn to shoot with point shooting fairly easily, and you've been learning to point all your life. Since you were first in the crib, you've been pointing at things that you wanted. Well, that's great, but you've never had a problem with that being deadly if it was done incorrectly. And that's why it's so important for people to be so comfortable with their firearm in their hand and the complete functional operation of that firearm, that when they then go to target focus shooting and doing things much more spontaneously and quickly, that all of those basic fundamentals are locked in place and muscle memory, so they're automatic and you don't have to think about them.
You know, I want to say that about half the time, and that's just a general estimate, people go to a gun store and they get a gun, they're okay. They get a gun that ends up working for them. The problem is the other half of the time, or even if it's only a quarter of the time, we get people that go out and make a pretty significant expenditure. You're talking anywhere from $400 to $600 or more. And then they come down and they want to get the training and they find out that's not the gun for them. Well, then they try to get a different gun. And the minute you buy a gun, it becomes a used gun typically. And anybody that wants to trade that gun is going to give you less value than you ultimately paid once you've walked away from the shop. So we like to think that the best option for people is to come down and see us first, consult with us, take a private lesson, experience a couple of different guns, and then ultimately pick the one that's right for you. Just in the last probably 2 weeks, I've had three individuals, one male and two females, who came down on Friday evening, spent anywhere from an hour to 2 hours with me in private lessons, and they were able to select the gun that worked for them. They went and bought their gun. Now they're starting to shoot it recreationally, preparing themselves for taking it for a concealed carry or some of the other advanced training classes that we have, and they're very satisfied with the gun they have because it fits them, it's good for them, they understand the functional operation, it's going to overall be a good buy.
And it doesn't have to be with us. We certainly think that's the best alternative. Not that we're biased or anything, but if you know someone who is familiar with guns and has several different models, and they can take you to the range and teach you to shoot them safely, and you can get to try several things, or there are other ranges around that also have gun rentals available. The most important thing is that you don't just walk into a store and buy a handgun because that's what they're selling you, or because the price was right, because the price is a factor, but it can't be the only factor. And if you get a gun that you could afford but you couldn't shoot, that you haven't really paid, you've wasted your money completely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to follow up when Mark's talking about there's plenty of other places out there to shoot. Something that I want you to consider, one of the places that we like to go to shoot our rifles and to have a nice day outdoors is down the Spring Valley Range, now that the Ohio Department of Natural Resources has done a wonderful job upgrading that range. I just want to caution our listeners to understand that shooting a pistol for the first time, or even if you're only shooting your pistol for a couple times a year at those distances, 65 to 75 feet or longer, isn't really getting you ready for what you might be intending to use that pistol for, and that would be defensive handgunning. You need to get somewhere where you're able to shoot at the distances from about 7 to 25 feet max and get used to shooting your firearm at those distances so that you can really develop competency, not only in the functional operation, but more importantly in the accuracy of that weapon at likely distances if you were ever to be involved in an encounter. And obviously at the longer distances, you're going to have to use aimed fire to begin with, and at those long distances, it's kind of impractical for most people to develop those skill sets they're going to apply in the situations that they're ultimately getting the gun for. But when we talk about the different types of firearms that are out there, again, I can't detract from the value of revolvers because they're tremendous guns, and there's a lot of people out there on the tremendous number of our listeners and a lot of people in the gun world that are using revolvers, and they've been reliable for many, many years. The semi-automatic pistols simply afford a little bit ease of operation in that the trigger maintenance, which is so critical to accurate shot placement, or to trigger management, I should say, is going to be the overriding factor. And I want you to give some thought to many of the good semi-autos out there. And again, I only mentioned three, but there are some others, and I just want to mention the Walther PPS. It's a new gun that's kind of hit the market. There haven't been a whole lot of reviews, but the Walther PPS, the kind of the draw on that particular firearm is that it is slim in the thickness of the gun, which ultimately improves the overall grip and makes it a little bit easier for people to handle.
One of the nice factors of the Smith & Wesson M&P series is that it has an adjustable backstrap. Some of the other guns, like the Glock, for example, which is a great gun and a lot of people like that, if your hand doesn't fit it, you're stuck. So if you have short hands or stubby fingers, then you need to get your finger on the trigger in the right place. If you have to turn your hand to do that, that's not good for your grip and for your total shooting process. The beauty of the Smith & Wesson is that you can change that backstrap, make that distance a little smaller. We've never found anyone yet that had a small hand that we couldn't fit with the smallest backstrap. So that's just one of the other options and why that one is also becoming quite popular.
Absolutely. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we've got several callers on the line. You can call in at 457-1290. You're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 News Talk Radio, WHIO. I want to welcome our listeners back to Shooting from the Hip, brought to you by Sim Trainer. We're located at 2031 Dryden Road down in Moraine, right across from DP&L. You can visit us on the web at www.sim-trainer.com, or you can call us at 937-293-3914. Today we're talking about weapon selection. And if you have any issues, you can certainly call us, set up an appointment. We'll be glad to help you out and get you where you need to be. I want to go to one of our callers. We have Tim from the Miamisburg Sportsman's Club in the line. Tim, you with us?
Yes, Tim. Good afternoon.
Tim, you say you have some exciting events coming up you want to let our listeners know about.
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
Next Saturday on August the 8th, we're having a charity shoot. It's called Maddie's Hope, and it's a shoot to cure childhood cancer. And the cost will be $15 for 75 targets. And the shooters get their choice of shooting either skeet, trap, or sporting clays, or any combination.
Okay. And what else do you have going on?
Okay. And also, we're having the annual Guns of August Regional Cowboy Championship. And that starts Thursday, and it runs through Saturday.
That's awesome, and I just want to stay on the line, Tim, because there's a few things I want to ask you, but I want to alert our listeners to the fact that Guns of August, even if you're not a cowboy shooter, it's a great event for shooting enthusiasts to attend and watch because there's a lot of fun things that occur. Mark, have you ever seen any of that on television or in life?
I have, yeah, and that might be something. Is this going to be all on the ground, or is this also include mounted?
They're going to have mounted and ground shooting both.
Super. Yeah, we may have to just come on down there for that.
That's right.
It'd be really worth your while. It is really a great sport.
Hey, Tim, why don't you take a couple minutes real quickly and just let us know what's the time, give us the times again of the events that you're just talking about.
Okay, on the shoot for the cure, that starts at 9 o'clock in the morning and runs until 4 o'clock. And on the cowboy shoot, they generally start at 8:30, and they're usually done by 4.
And that's going to go all weekend, correct?
Yes, that'll be going on from Thursday through Saturday. And they will have all the vendors there for all the Old West equipment as far as guns, period, clothing, just anything you need.
Is a chuck wagon going to be up and running?
Yes, I think so. But instead of a chuck wagon, I think it's going to be more of a modern, what do you call those things? Like a
canteen or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
okay. Just so they're having food, I'm there.
Pardon me?
Just so they're having some food, I'll be there.
Oh, yes, it'll be there. Don't worry.
All right.
It'll be good, too.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I thank you for calling, and I hope some of our listeners have the opportunity to tune in. And I also want to alert some of our listeners to tune in to Channel 101, the outdoor channel, on Wednesday evenings, pretty much from about 6 o'clock till the wee hours of the morning. And they typically have, at least every other week, an episode involving cowboy shooting, and it's a lot of fun to watch. And if you can get the opportunity to get down to the Middletown Sportsman Club this weekend, you're going to see some real action, and you get to see some real fun shooting. And see, the nice thing about that is the camaraderie that goes along with the participants. Mark,
it's absolutely true. There's everybody that's active in the Single Action Shooting Society says the same thing, that it's a great family activity. And it's one place where the women are talking about the guns and guys are talking about the clothes, because there's an outfit for everybody's got their own Western outfit and different accessories, and it really is a lot of fun. Great family activity.
The other thing, Mark, why don't you tell the listeners about we one of the things we try to promote is some of the fundraising that we're doing for various groups, and the gentleman from Middletown Sportsman Club mentioned that's a great cause, and what a great way to help raise money. You're going to have a fun time, and that money's going to a tremendously worthy cause. Just last Thursday night, we did a First Shots class for ovarian cancer, and it was filled up. We filled it to capacity, and it was a great feeling to present that organization with a check for $500, since we donated the entire proceeds of the evening to that worthy cause. And Mark has another thing that he wants to talk about.
Yeah, we do. And a couple of weeks ago, Bob Glaves was here from the Freedom Alliance Charity Golf Classic, which is actually going on right now. They had a first run yesterday afternoon, and the second run is started this morning. So they're down there at Pipestone Golf Course, and they're doing a charity golf classic. And when they were out here, we offered to do a special First Shots for them, and it's going to be tomorrow afternoon. So if you've always wanted to get into First Shots and get an introduction to handguns, and you've looked at the schedule and you see that a lot of our classes are filled up long in advance, well, this is an opportunity for you to get in just a day in advance. You don't even have to make any long-term plans. Join us at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at Sim Trainer Range. Give us a call at 293-3914 and book a slot. We still have several slots available for that. And, again, all the proceeds are going to the Freedom Alliance, which is the charity that Ollie North and Sean Henney's been promoting with the Freedom Alliance concerts. That there's going to be one just later this month down at Kings Island. So all of the proceeds will be going to support that fund that helps to provide for the children of our fallen heroes. So it's a great charity, and it's a great benefit, and plus it'll be a whole lot of fun. So come on down and join us.
That's great. I mean, this is just another way that we're promoting the shooting sports and putting it in a positive light. I think next week Mark and I are going to have to arm wrestle over who's going to go down there to the Middletown Sportsman Club, because that might be a great opportunity for us to do a little bit of remote. And so we'll talk about that this week and see who's going to go down there. And one of us will stay back here and hold down the fort, and the other one will go down there, and we'll be able to bring our listeners some live activity of what's going on down at that great cowboy shoot. Let's go to another caller. We have Chuck from Tip, wants to talk about a new law that passed reference self-defense. Chuck, you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, sir.
Calling.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I'm out of the car now. I'll make it quick. A few years ago when I took my CPW license, they informed us that pretty much had to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that your life was in jeopardy before you shot an intruder. Now, I'm under the impression that this law has changed within the last year or so, and now if somebody breaks in, you get what you get.
Well, that's not necessarily the case. Regardless of where you're at and regardless of the change in the law, the bottom line is when you use deadly force, when you use force that's likely to cause death or serious bodily injury by shooting someone with a firearm, you're going to be kind of in a situation where it has to be where your life or someone else's life was in imminent jeopardy. And Mark will go ahead and talk to you a little bit more about the Castle Doctrine and some of those provisions.
Right.
What's the document?
It's the Castle Doctrine, which is a doctrine that says if you live in your castle, your home is your castle and you can defend it. What changed, and it went into effect in September of last year, was that the burden of proof no longer rests on you, the person who defended yourself. Now, if you are in your home or in your vehicle and you defend yourself with a firearm, it is a rebuttable presumption that you were defending yourself and that it was indeed self-defense. You won't have to prove beyond by a preponderance of the evidence in court that it was self-defense. It's up to the prosecutor to prove that it was not. So that's the change. You still we got to take a break here. Since we're at the bottom of the hour, but we'll have more information about that. You're on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio WHIO. Welcome back to Shooting from the Hip, and thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Mark Avery. I'm here with Jeff Pedro. We're from Sim Trainer, which is the Dayton area's first indoor range and firearms training facility. And we'd love to have you come down and shoot and take some of our classes and maybe even become a member and shoot recreationally. I want to add a little bit to what we talked about just before the bottom of the hour when we're talking about the Castle Doctrine and what that means in terms of how that changed the law and what it does in terms of your responsibilities for self-defense. It doesn't matter. That law did not change the requirement for when it is appropriate to use deadly force. You still need to be in fear of grave bodily harm or death. You have to have a reasonable and honest belief that that is imminent and that is about to occur. You still have to not be at fault for having created the situation. And you still have to have no duty to retreat. Now, if you're in your own home or in your own vehicle, that duty is already fulfilled. You don't have a duty to retreat. But anywhere else, you still need to, the first option is to get away from the situation if at all possible. Now, if somebody threatens you with a firearm, obviously you're not going to be able to outrun a bullet. So you can't possibly retreat fast enough. That's not so much of an issue. What changed in the law is what your responsibilities are in defense and what the prosecutor's responsibilities are. If you are in your own home or in a home that you have a right to be in, or if you're in your vehicle or family vehicle and you defend yourself with a firearm, you no longer have to prove that it was self-defense. Before that law went into effect at the end of on the 9th of September, you would have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, in other words, more than 50-50, that it was self-defense, and you would have to present your own case. All the prosecutor would have to do is prove that somebody got shot and that you did it, and you would already have admitted that. You'd probably be the one that called 911 and had the police come out and take the report and do everything that follows that. Now, in your own home or in your own vehicle, if you defend yourself, it's no longer your burden of proof. It's the it's a on the prosecutor to prove that it was not self-defense. So you still have to have all of those same parameters for the use of deadly force. If somebody comes into your house and they're not supposed to be there, but they're not a deadly threat, you don't have the right to just shoot them. That's not what that law changed. So there's, just to clarify that just a little bit, on the stuff that we talked about at the end of the last half hour.
Yeah, that's a good point, and that's what people just need to keep in mind. The whole issue is imminent jeopardy, meaning your life or someone else's life is likely to, you're either going to be killed or seriously injured if you don't take action. And I just want to reiterate one thing about many people talk about, well, you know, I have my pickup truck parked out in my driveway, and all of a sudden I hear the glass break, and I look out and I see somebody breaking into my pickup truck. Well, I don't care if your pickup truck's a 2009 Ford, which I hope that's what you chose these days, but whatever the case might be. Government Motors, but okay. I prefer Ford. That you just can't go out there and use deadly force in order to try to get them to go away, and you're going to be able to call the police in that particular case, and then you're going to just have them be a good witness, and you're not going to be able to use deadly force to stop them from stealing your property.
No, it is appropriate for you to use force if you choose to. It can't be deadly force. If you decide to go out there and stop somebody from doing something to your vehicle, it's perfectly legitimate for you to use some level of force that's appropriate. Deadly force is not appropriate.
So. Yeah, the law states in the state of Ohio authorizes anybody to make an arrest if they're witnessing a felony. And obviously, if somebody's going to try to steal your vehicle, that would be a felony. You'd be authorized in making an arrest. The issue then comes into the level of force. And again, you're going to be governed by the fact the only way you can use deadly force is if your life or someone else's life is in imminent jeopardy. Then the other issue comes into play is the amount of reasonable force you use in detaining them. For example, if you grabbed them, held them on the ground, called 911, that likely would be determined to be reasonable. However, there's other things that you might do that may not later in a court of law be determined to be very reasonable. So it's the reasonableness of your actions that's typically the guide, as opposed to somebody sitting back Monday morning quarterbacking your decisions and saying, that's not what I would have done at that particular time. They look at what you did at that time based on the circumstances you were faced with.
And what you honestly and reasonably believed was the situation. One other thing on grave bodily harm, rape is considered grave bodily harm. So even if you don't think that the person was out to kill you, ladies, if you believe that it was a sexual assault and that there was that would constitute grave bodily harm, and use of deadly force to defend yourself was certainly authorized.
Right. One thing I also wanted to alert our listeners to is the fact that one of the reasons we offer the legal update as a standalone portion of our concealed carry class is because there are plenty of people out there who have gotten their concealed carry permit and they've not had the opportunity to really listen to a thorough overview of the law, both from the criminal and civil end. And our attorney, our prosecuting attorney that comes in, does a tremendous job of not only setting forth the various elements of the various laws that are involved, but he takes you through a series of scenarios. And quite frankly, just like I and Mark and other people, we don't like everything he has to say. But you leave there knowing what you can and can't do and what you should and shouldn't do so that you're much better informed and you can make more informed decisions, as opposed to just going to a class, shooting a few bullets, reading the book and saying, wow, if I ever get involved in a situation like that, what am I going to do?
Yeah, if you want to come to that class, we do offer it as part of the concealed carry. Anytime we offer a concealed carry class, you can come take just that legal portion, but you might want to bring duct tape for your head. There are a few times when otherwise it might explode.
Yeah, there are plenty of places, and again, we've been talking about tracking various types of legislation, and I'll remind the listeners that just a couple weeks ago, there was an important piece of legislation that was going to possibly authorize national concealed carry. It failed by only two votes, and the anti-gun people kind of promoted that as a victory. Well, you know what? It wasn't a victory. It's only a matter of time now, ladies and gentlemen. I just want to alert you to the fact that it's around the corner.
One of the things that vote in the Senate showed us was that we actually have 58 senators who agree that citizens, law-abiding citizens, should be allowed to take their, if they've gone through whatever their state requires to carry a concealed handgun, they should be able to carry that across state lines without having to go through any sort of generic hoops of getting additional licenses or special negotiated reciprocity between the states. Just like your driver's license that allows you to drive, it's issued in Ohio and you can drive in any state in the country, your license to carry concealed handgun should be exactly the same thing. And we have 58 senators who are already declared as on the side of that. The anti-gunners love to call that a loss for the gun rights, but I don't know, 58-39 sounds like a win in my book.
Absolutely, because the next time it comes around, the experts in the 60. Area, that's right, it won't need 60, and the experts in the area think that it's going to go in our favor. And I want to let you know that most all the anti-gun legislation is losing momentum on a daily basis today. They're either stuck in committee, they're not getting any sponsors, things just aren't going anywhere, they're spinning their wheels because, quite frankly, when you're doing the right thing, it's easy to be on the right side. And they're trying to do the wrong thing, and they're grasping, they're doing whatever they can to try to throw a wrench in the system.
We've talked about some of the various different legislation since the very first show. The Blair Holt bill came up on the first show, and it still has no sponsors. H.R. 197, which would give concealed carry, it's actually even better than the bill that was going to be in the, that was in the Senate as an amendment, because it would allow you to carry in every state, whether they allow their own citizens to carry or not. So that would be a good thing, and we think you should support that and let your representative know. If they're not on the list, you can go to our website at sim-trainer.com/radio and click on the link for that bill, and you can see if your representative is a sponsor, a co-sponsor for that bill.
Exactly, and I want to encourage you to do that. Tell you what, we're going to go to a break now, and when we come back, we're going to go to Dave. Dave, stay with us. You're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290, 95.7, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hey, welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro with Shooting from the Hip. We're glad to have you. Come give us a call at 457-1290 if you'd like to be on the show. There's one more event that we hadn't talked about, and that is the Shooting from the Hip Beer Summit.
We're not going to
do a beer summit. No. Oh, okay. All right, so let's go talk to Dave in Xenia. Dave, you have a question about concealed carry?
Yes, I do. I have a question concerning carrying it with riding a bicycle.
Okay.
I know it's legal on an automobile to have it in a locked box or a glove compartment or a console, but there's no such item on a bicycle, and carrying it in a holster on my body would probably result in the firearm being soaked with perspiration after a while. So I was wondering if some type of attached case on the bicycle would be considered the same thing as a glove compartment.
I think your best option, besides the attached case on the bicycle, is going to be a fanny pack. Yeah. I mean, that's almost the universal solution to your problem, and you need to be careful to make sure you get a fanny pack that's strong enough and designed specifically to carry the gun in a safe manner. Go ahead, Mark.
The fanny pack doesn't raise the geek factor as much on a bicycle as it does, like when, you know, Jeff wears one walking around, or when I wear one walking around. But since I've already pegged the geek meter, it doesn't really matter for me. Some people are concerned about that. On a bike, everybody's wearing a fanny pack because you got a place to put, you know, water bottle and wallet and so forth. So we do have fanny packs. There are many companies that make fanny packs that are specifically designed for concealed carry. And that really is the best way to do that, because it doesn't it keeps it far enough off your body that you don't have the perspiration problem, but it's still on your person. And so you have it available when you need it. You need to practice with it. You need to be very comfortable with the operation of it and know how, you know, what you have to do to get in and out of it. But really, a fanny pack on a bike or other kind of sporting activity is really a good way to do that.
Best option.
Yeah, well, I already have a rather husky Cordura nylon bag on the front of the handlebars, which is inches from my hands, and it's very convenient. Is there a legal issue with carrying it there?
No, there's not. There's not a legal issue in regards to that. The restrictions on how you can carry apply to a motor vehicle, so that does apply to a motorcycle, but not to a bicycle.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thanks for giving us a call. Let's go to Don in Huber Heights. Don, you got a question for us on Shooting from the Hip?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, thanks. Give it.
Are you there?
Yes, we're here. Give us. What's your question?
Well, I'm wondering. I keep a gun in my house. Now, I'm a combat Vietnam veteran.
Thank you for your service.
And what's your question about keeping that gun in your house?
Is it legal for me to have a gun in my house?
Absolutely. There's no restriction at all for you having a gun loaded in your home, ready at hand for your own personal safety and self-defense. The only issues that come up, and we talk about all the time, are safety around the home, but you're totally legal.
What about, like you say, in a car? Is there special rules about having a gun in a car?
Absolutely. In order to carry a gun loaded in a car, you're going to have to go get yourself a concealed carry permit, and then there's various ways that you can carry that gun, and we spell those out on various shows. But once you get the permit, that becomes pretty obvious that you'd be able to carry it on your person or in a container inside the vehicle. But until you get that permit, you're not going to be able to carry it loaded in your car.
And unloaded in your car means not only is there no ammunition in the gun, but there's no ammunition in any speed loaders or magazines that can be used with that gun.
What about shotgun racks in the back window of a pickup truck?
For a shotgun, you can have an unloaded with an action open shotgun in the back window. But again, the same applies. There are some special requirements for long guns.
I want to also caution you to kind of be reasonable about that, because maybe out in the middle of a rural area in some aspects or areas of Ohio, that'd be okay. But in an urban area, a shotgun in the back window is going to probably invite somebody to break in and steal the gun. So unless you're going to be with the gun at all times, I don't think that's a pretty good idea for you to do.
Do you need a permit to have shotguns?
No, you do not, sir.
But as long as it's unloaded. So it wouldn't be something that you could use for personal defense on short notice. You'd have to have it unloaded in the vehicle.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Don, thanks for giving us a call. Let's go to Barb in Springboro. Barb, you have a question on carrying in a different state.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
When I obtained my concealed carry license, I got a little card that says there are 26 states where the Ohio license is valid. Is that incorrect?
No, that's not incorrect. That's actually, it's now, I think, 27, because Nevada just on the 1st of July started recognizing the Ohio license.
Okay, so there are some reciprocal states.
Oh, yes, there are.
Okay.
In fact, the main thing is that card came from the Buckeye Firearms Association, I believe,
yes, sir.
And they do a great job in getting word out. The difference is between reciprocity, and we have, I think, 18 states with which Ohio has reciprocity, where there's an agreement between the other state and the Ohio Attorney General to allow and recognize licenses going both directions. But there are several other states that also recognize your Ohio license, and that list on your card is a pretty
correct.
Good summary.
Okay, that's what I need to know.
Okay, great. Thanks
and,
for
well,
calling
one
the show.
Other thing. The fellow that called earlier, being a female in the car, as long as I have, say, my purse, which zips, I can carry that loaded gun, right?
Yes, you can, because that's considered a closed case. A case that has a zipper, for example, is a latching mechanism. It does not have to be locked as long as it's in plain sight when it's in your car. So that's,
now, if it's in my purse.
No, I'm not talking about the gun. The gun is obviously going to be concealed
container.
Inside the purse, but the purse itself has
the
to be
container.
In plain sight.
Okay.
So you can't put it under the seat.
Okay.
You need to have it someplace where it can be visible from the outside of the vehicle,
right.
And then you can use your purse.
Right.
And you just want to make absolutely sure, if you're going to carry your gun in a purse, that you don't lose the purse. I mean, you have to keep it on your person all the time.
Right.
You can't, like, hang it over the back of the chair or set it on the floor under your feet or anything like
right.
that.
The other thing I want to mention about purses while we're on the topic is I want you ladies to be very cautious of the fact that you want that gun to be separated from anything else in that purse. You don't want to throw it in with your makeup
right.
case or any of the other things in there, because when it comes time to get it, you don't want to be rooting through all those other items. So I recommend you have a designated area in the purse where you have nothing but the firearm for ease of access.
Which
really,
true, and you also want to make sure that it stays on safety.
Well, it depends on the type of firearm that you have. Most of the firearms don't have built-in safety, so the whole issue is that you're going to be able to get it safely, and it's not going to be bumping up against other things in your purse.
Right. All right,
okay.
Sir. Thank you.
Thank
Barb,
you for your car,
so much
Barb.
For calling. Call Barb. Let's talk to David in Sydney. David, you have a question for us?
Yeah. I have a 12-year-old son, and I want to get him into a gun safety class where they teach him how to, you know, carry the weapon, shoot the weapon.
Okay.
The whole nine yards. Who would I call and check in with to get him into some kind of a class like that?
Well, I think probably the best thing you could do would be to bring him to First Shots. And we have a First Shots class that's going to be tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock, which we talked about a little bit earlier. It's a benefit for the Freedom Alliance. And so if you call the range at 293-3914 and register him for that class. It's a 3-hour class, and we cover all the basic fundamentals of the, especially safety. We start out with that. In fact, we start out with that in every class, and then go to the functional operation of the handgun, and then we go out into the range, and he gets a little bit of time behind the gun, and it's a great class. We take anyone really from age 10 and up, so a 12-year-old is a perfect age to be doing that. In fact, I'd recommend you come with him because it's a great family activity.
Absolutely. In addition, if you can't make it tomorrow, we have another one coming up on the 8th. And the nice thing about it, in addition to all the other benefits, you get a free associate membership to the range so you can start coming shooting recreationally with him.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for calling. We're at the top of the hour, so we've one more time. Another hour has flown by on Shooting from the Hip. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Don't forget to tune in to us next week at 2 o'clock on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.